Are you a man above the age of 18? Do you live in Arizona? Have you joined your local criminal hunting posse? Because it is actually required by law that men in Arizona join a local criminal hunting posse. I'm quoting straight from the compiled laws of the territory of Arizona from 1864 through 1871. Every male person above 18 years of age who shall neglect or refuse to join the posse comitatus, that would be citizens law enforcement committees, by neglecting or refusing to aid and assist in taking or arresting any person shall be fined in any sum, not less than $50 nor more than $1,000. So join that posse comitatus or fork over maybe as much as $1,000. Here's another law from that same compendium on the sale of liquor to indigenous people. Any person who has been guilty of selling or giving spirituous liquor to any Indian within this territory shall be fined for the first offense $25. Totally racist, totally outdated. But again, that is Arizona law circa 1864. And here's another one on animal theft. Every person who shall brand or deface the mark or brand of any horse, mare, colt, jack, gentle, mule, sheep, goat, hog, shoat, or pig that is not his or her own property shall be punished by imprisonment in the territorial prison for a term not less than 1 year nor more than 5 years. Now, if you were wondering, a shoat is like a preteen pig. And do not deface its brand, or you might find yourself in the Arizona clink for up to 5 years. Those were the laws of the land in Arizona in the mid to late 1800s. At the time, Arizona was not yet a state. It would not become one for another 5 decades. But it was an important American territory. In 1862, the Confederacy and the Union fought for control of Arizona, and the Union won at the height of the Civil War, when states and territories like Arizona looked something like this. Dirt roads with horse-drawn buggies, and only white men had the right to vote. In 1864, slavery was not yet abolished, and the question of whether the United States would remain united and free was being answered in a war that wouldn't end until 1865 and would result in the deaths of more than 600,000 Americans, two-thirds of whom died from infectious diseases, not artillery fire. And that's because in the 1860s, doctors were still figuring out what germs were. It was not yet common practice for doctors to wash their hands before surgery or when delivering a baby. 1864 was before doctors knew how reproduction worked on a cellular level, you know, with the eggs and the sperm. And it was under those conditions where basic reproduction was still a mystery, where basic medical protocols were not yet in place, and all men had to be part of something called a posse comitatus. It was under those conditions in 1864 that legislators in the Arizona Territory passed a near total ban on abortion, punishing anyone who performed an abortion with up to 5 years in prison. Today, Arizona's Supreme Court upheld that 160-year-old law. The court determined that thanks to the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision, that Civil War-era abortion ban is still in effect. The decision overturned Arizona's already restrictive 15-week abortion ban from the year 2022, and it replaced it with that law from the antebellum period. After Dobbs, abortion advocates and leaders said the Supreme Court ruling had set the country back 50 years to the days before Roe was decided in 1973. But in reality, states like Arizona have been set back more than 160 years to the days before women could vote and before America outlawed slavery. In the wake of the Arizona court's ruling, the state's top Democratic elected officials swiftly condemned this decision.
It is a dark day in Arizona. The near total Civil War era ban that continues to hang over our heads only serves to create more chaos for women and doctors in our state.
Let me be completely clear. As long as I am Attorney General of the state of Arizona, no woman or doctor will be prosecuted under this draconian law.
This is going to criminalize doctors for doing their jobs, and it's going to have a devastating effect on the health and freedom of women in Arizona.
So now the question is, what happens next? The implementation of this law will be delayed as the decision is appealed, but depending on the outcome of that appeal, pregnant women face a harsh new reality in the South, because it is not just the women of Arizona here. It is women seeking abortion access in places like Texas, women who were already traveling to Arizona to get that abortion care. And now an entire region of this country could be going dark. 160 years after the Civil War, we are witnessing a resurgent confederacy of anti-abortion states. In Arizona, choice advocates are already working to ensure that voters get a chance to decide this November on a ballot initiative that would enshrine the right to an abortion in the state constitution. Those advocates have already collected 500,000 signatures, which is 120,000 more than they need to get abortion on the ballot. And now that vote will be more critical than ever. Republicans have just put the future of abortion access on the line in a critical swing state in an election year. Joining me now is Democratic Senator Mark Kelly from Arizona. Senator, thank you for joining me tonight. You know the sort of complicated dynamics around what happens next probably better than most. We know that Attorney General Chris Mayes has said she is not going to prosecute women or doctors who are involved in abortion. She was granted that right by the governor of the state. Are you optimistic about, you know, sort of women's prospects if they're seeking abortion care given that stipulation, or does it not matter?
Well, let me start, Alex, by saying that this is a unmitigated disaster for women in the state of Arizona. I mean, they deserve to be able to make this choice themselves, not from a politician in Washington or the state Supreme Court. And that ended today. And let's be clear how this happened. I mean, this is because of Donald Trump, who he appointed to the Supreme Court and ending Roe v. Wade, a law that was on the books for decades. So this is a really, really bad day in Arizona. To answer your question, yeah, I heard what the attorney general has said. That's certainly a positive thing. But in 14 days, abortion clinics and women, you know, health clinics are going to close, doctors are going to flee the state, and that puts women at risk.
Do you have any amount of optimism? You talk about the 14-day window here about the appeals process. I mean, this, for anybody who is watching what's happening in the state of Arizona, this is so appalling and so out of step with the modern era that one wonders how an appeals court could let it stand. But then again, the state Supreme Court made the decision. So I just wonder about your level of optimism in terms of
right.
the judicial process.
Yeah, not a lot. I mean, the Supreme Court has ruled. They had some questions for the lower court. We're going to fight this all the way up to Election Day, you know, certainly here in the next 14 days. This is a 160-year-old law. This was 50 years before Arizona was even a state. And keep in mind, this legislation, or this, you know, this law that's 160 years old could send doctors to jail for just trying to, you know, help women and give them the health care they need. So I want to be, you know, very clear about this. This would not be the situation in Arizona if Donald Trump didn't essentially call for Roe v. Wade to be overturned. He talked about that yesterday. We're going to have to find a path forward here.
Yeah, it's a conservative judiciary, the Supreme Court. Certainly there are Republicans on the state Supreme Court that were responsible, or people who were appointed by Republicans who are responsible for this decision, four men and one woman. What does this do to the political dynamics in an election year, given the way abortion, on whenever it is litigated at the ballot box, redounds to the benefit of people in favor of choice? What does this do for the broader dynamics going into November?
Well, I think the first thing we've got to be concerned about is the health care for women in the state. It's been hard already since Roe was overturned. I've spoken to, doctors who provided women health care who have left the state already. They've moved to Nevada. They've moved on to other states. So the options for women have decreased. That's going to get worse with what happened today. We do have an opportunity here in November to codify the right for women to make this choice on their own, to get the politics out of it. I hope that passes. I expect it will. I'm going to be fighting for it. And we're going to look for other avenues to try to fix this between now and Election Day.
You know, senators are frequently expected to be boosters for their own states. And I wonder what you say to the residents of your state and those that are looking at your state today about what has happened. This is the most draconian, regressive, reproductive health bill, health law in the country by a long shot.
Well, I'll start with that elections matter. The election in 2016 certainly had an impact on women's health care in the state of Arizona and other states, for that matter, across the country. We've seen that with the election of the former president. We're going to make sure that Joe Biden wins Arizona and gets reelected, and we can, from somebody who served in the Navy for 25 years, we can right this ship. So elections do matter. There are ways to fix this. Not a good day for Arizona, but we also had a good announcement yesterday with the CHIPS and Science Act grant money for the semiconductor industry. But today, was the opposite of that. It was a very disappointing day.
Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona, thank you again for your time. So really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I want to turn now to White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre. Karine, thank you for being here tonight. I know the president had a statement on this. He said this ruling is a result of the extreme agenda of Republican elected officials who are committed to ripping away women's freedom. When Republicans try to rip away women's freedoms, Karine, it doesn't usually go well for them. Why are they so committed to this issue?
Look, it's a question for them certainly to answer, but I want to just lay out what the senator said, Senator Mark Kelly, who was just on right before me. He just laid out what this means for women now in Arizona. What we saw today, it is wrong. It is shameful. It is dangerous what women now in Arizona are going to have to go through. There are 21 extreme state bans across the country. And it is because of what extreme Republicans elected officials have been able to do. This started with the Dobbs decision. This started with the overturning of Roe v. Wade. This, what we're seeing today in Arizona and states across the country, is the Republicans' plan on abortion. And here's the thing, Alex, they can't run away from it. They can't turn away from it or hide from it. This is theirs. They own this. The reason that we are in the situation right now is because the former president put judges, along with the help of Senate Republicans, put judges on the Supreme Court to make this happen, to overturn Roe v. Wade, what was a constitutional right for almost 50 years. Now, we have these types of bans across the country that makes it very difficult for women to get health care. They get turned away from life-saving procedures and getting life-saving procedures. They get turned away from emergency rooms. They are banning IVF. They are trying to criminalize doctors. This is their doing. And so they own this now. And what the president is trying to do, and you heard this in his statement, and you heard him say this over and over again, you heard this from the vice president as well and from the administration, is that they want to protect women's rights, right? Women's right to make a choice on their own bodies. It is something that they should make a choice on. And so we're going to continue to fight. We're going to continue to say, hey, you know what? We need to legislate this issue, make sure that Roe v. Wade becomes a law of the land. And you said something during the your interview with the senator, which is every time abortion is on the ballot, Ohio, Michigan, Kansas, Kentucky, California, Vermont. Every time it's on the ballot, majority of Americans vote to protect our reproductive freedoms, vote to protect a woman's right to choose. That's what we have seen. We are standing on the side of majority of Americans, and we are in lockstep with them. And Republicans, they don't seem to care. They don't seem to care what majority of Americans care about, making sure that our freedoms are protected.
I do wonder, is there, apart from urging Americans to vote and exercising their democratic rights and, you know, criticizing Republicans for their decision to, as the White House says, rip away women's freedoms, is there anything this administration can do to protect federal employees, military service members in Arizona? Is there any sort of, you know, oasis, if you will, for reproductive freedom that can be established by the federal government in a moment like this?
So, look, the president on day one that when Dobbs were decided and obviously Roe was overturned, he signed two executive orders to do everything that we can from HHS perspective and DOJ to do what we can to protect women as they're trying to get just procedures or just health care, make decisions on their own body. But really, the best way to move forward is to get legislation done. Now, we're going to continue to stand with our partners, state partners, to do everything that we can. They're the ones who are on the front lines to make sure that women are getting access. So obviously, we're going to stand with them. But look, the way to truly deal with this, we got to get legislation done. We have to. And as I stated, every time, I can't speak to 2024. I can't talk about an upcoming election as a federal employee. So I don't want to get into predictions here, but I can talk about what we've seen in the past. And as I mentioned, I listed out a bunch of states that have had an abortion ballot initiative in that election year. And what we've seen is majority of Americans stand for protecting reproductive rights. And so that's what we have seen. And so it is shameful that now in Arizona, this decision that is made, we're going back to 1964. You did such a great job laying
18,
out.
Yeah.
I'm 18. Sorry, 1864?
Not even.
Not even. 1864. And you did such a great job laying out what was going on during that time. And that's what we are. That's where we are right now in Arizona. So this is a really horrific day, a sad day for the women of Arizona, but this is what we're seeing in many states across the country. And so we have to stand with women across the country. We have to stand for our freedoms, and that's what you're going to see from this administration.
Yeah, it's worth noting that Republican lawmakers in Arizona are currently blocking a bill that would protect contraception in the state.
And they said in the Dobbs decision, we heard them. They say that's what they were going to go after next, contraception. It wasn't just going to stop at overturning Roe, and they've kept their promise.
Corrine, I know just really quickly, the Republican Party likes to call itself the party of family values. The president did something today that I know the White House wants to talk about, which is how we actually take care of our families as a country, as individuals. Do you want to talk a little bit about the moves this administration is making on that front?
So when you think about the care economy, the president had an event to lift that up, and he has done, this Biden-Harris administration has done transformational investment in health care, in paid leave, in health care. And he signed the CARE EO just last year. That was the American Rescue Plan, which was the first piece of legislation that he signed into law, the CHIPS and Science Act. All of that is an investment in our child care, paid leave. And here's the thing. You know, Americans across the country should not have to make a difficult decision sometimes that they do have to make, which is, do they take care of their parents who raised them, or do they take care of their child? We should not have to make those types of decisions. So the president understands that. He's made those investments. And what this would lead to as well is making tax cuts for workers, people who truly, truly need a little bit of breathing room, a little bit of that dignity that the president talks about. And what you see from Republicans, as you were asking me, this question, Republicans is a complete contrast. They put forward a budget, Alex, that cuts Medicare, Social Security, health care, paid leave, all of the things that workers, everyday people need. They want to do dramatic cuts to those really important programs that Americans need. And they do it because they want to give a tax cut to billionaires and corporations. That's not how we see how we should move forward. The president has always been clear. He wants to build an economy that's built from the bottom up and middle out.
Yeah, apparently any new programs have to be run under the 1864 test. Were they doing it in the run-up to the end of the Civil War? If not, we're not going to pass it. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, thank you, my friend, for your time tonight.
Thank you. Thank you, Alex. Appreciate it.
Coming up, Donald Trump's attempts to delay his Manhattan trial today got shot down by a judge in what may be a new land speed record. We're going to explain that coming up. But first, it was just yesterday that the presumptive Republican nominee was saying abortion was best left to the states. And today, one of those states upheld an abortion law which predated the end of the Civil War. We're going to discuss the Republican plan to tackle abortion when the New York Times' Jamelle Bouie joins me. That's next.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com. Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at MSNBC.com/win.
Today, Arizona's highest court, four men and two women, all appointed by Republicans, decided that when given the option of a 15-week abortion ban passed 2 years ago and a near-total abortion ban passed 160 years ago, they decided to go with the Civil War-era ban. That news follows the decision last week from Florida's right-leaning state Supreme Court, allowing a six-week ban to take effect next month in that state. And that ruling came on the heels of Alabama's Supreme Court that sent conservatives scrambling when it ruled that embryos are children, which in turn upended IVF treatment across that state. Now, yesterday, Donald Trump attempted to neutralize what is becoming a major campaign issue for him by saying he would leave abortion up to the states. But today we saw yet again what happens when abortion is left up to the states, particularly conservative states with conservative judiciaries. The outcomes are extreme, and for most Republicans, they are politically disastrous. Joining me now is Jamelle Bouie, New York Times opinion columnist. Jamelle, thank you for being here. Yesterday, a lot of people were saying, oh, Trump's, you know, sort of whatever we're calling it, middle line, though I would beg to differ, is a good piece of strategy. That was Monday. Today, we see what happens in Arizona, and I just wonder whether you still think leaving it up to the states is a good strategy for him to pursue.
I mean, I think it's sort of the only strategy for him to pursue because a national ban, it's just so toxic with most voters. But it's also clear that leaving it up to the states is really leaving it up to the whims of, in this case, a packed Republican Supreme Court in Arizona, gerrymandered state legislatures, right? In plenty of places, the majority of voters may well support abortion rights, but the state legislatures are so gerrymandered against basically sort of the popular will that it's impossible to get that preference passed into law. So that's what leaving it to the states means. I think voters, I think most people are kind of aware of that. They can see that happening. But as far as Trump is concerned, there's not really any place for him to go other than, oh, we have to leave it to the states.
It also seems like it's the kind of the harvest of a multi-decade project on the part of the far right, which is to inject conservative Christian principles into the judiciary, right? You see these state Supreme Court judges in Alabama, in Florida, in Arizona, who have been radicalized and are now on very influential benches, or they're in, you know, smaller areas in Texas, like Judge Kaczmarek, but get to make these just giant decisions that have statewide import, if not national import. And it sort of feels like the dog that caught the car, if you're a conservative, right? This is part of the long project to, you know, reverse liberal jurisprudence, and this is what you get.
I think there's an interesting thing going on here where I'm not sure, like conservatives, their project was we're going to capture the judiciary and then through the judiciary, we're going to impose our preferred, you know, social order, our preferred moral order on the rest of the country. And that's going to require winning elections. But you'll note that they never ran candidates, they never ran on this promise to do this, right? It's a bit of a bait and switch. And so I think the thing that conservatives and Republicans are running into is that it's one thing to win elections. It's one thing to be able to appoint these judges, but you still actually do need some degree of popular buy-in to your project. And that buy-in just doesn't exist. And I don't think Republicans or conservatives really know how to deal with it whatsoever and are risking a situation, right, in which like all of these gains they've made are reversed by the force of the backlash against them.
Yeah, I do wonder as a piece of political theater, because you know that Trump doesn't really have any other space to play in but to suggest this be returned to the states. Do you think that convinces the people it needs to convince? Because he certainly has the levers to end abortion nationally without passing a federal abortion ban. They could just go back to the Comstock Act of the late 1800s and decide to enforce that, and then no abortion medication can be mailed in the U.S. Post. Do you think it's subtly a sort of a nod to a different way of outlawing abortion? Do you think generally this is actually going to convince the people that Trump does not want to end reproductive freedom nationally?
So I think that if Trump gets another term in office, he is going to try to end abortion nationally through any means he has. That's sort of what the coalition behind him wants. And there's no evidence that he's going to push back against that. I think as far as trying to like persuade the public that, you know, I'm not going to ban abortion. Because it's one thing, right, for us to recognize this in terms of politics, but for the public to sort of believe that Trump is not going to do it, I think there's one thing going in his favor, and that is people generally don't believe that Donald Trump has any particular personal problem with abortion, right? Sort of like people believe, oh, that Donald Trump is totally a guy who's probably paid for an abortion. That's how people perceive him. And that perception really helps in terms of him trying to distance himself from Republicans like Ron DeSantis or Mike Pence or whomever. The thing that's working against him is that every day we get new stories of the horrors that that happen when women cannot get access to reproductive health care, when they cannot get access to abortion care. And those stories resonate with people across the country. Many people have their own stories, and Trump can't escape that. Also, Democrats are clearly going to work very hard to remind voters and tell voters again and again and again, with Trump's help, that Trump is responsible for this state of affairs. He appointed the judges that overturned Roe v. Wade. He has been a loyal supporter, foot soldier, for this cause of banning abortion.
Yeah, all roads end at Dobbs, and we know who is responsible for the justices that made the Dobbs decision. Jamelle Bouie, thank you for joining me tonight. I appreciate your time, my friend. Coming up, 99% of the $3 billion of money flowing into Jared Kushner's investment fund is coming from foreign sources. But that fact should not alarm anyone, according to Jared Kushner. We'll talk to Ben Rhodes about the real-world implications of that little arrangement. But first, today it took a New York judge all of 12 minutes to throw out Trump's latest legal challenge. What happened in that Manhattan criminal trial is coming up next.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
here on MSNBC. We are staying on top of several fast-moving stories.
Today's news requires more facts.
A new report finds the climate crisis is getting much worse.
More context.
We are seeing record numbers of people crossing into the United States just in the southern border.
And more ground covered.
The mission will continue to carry out regime change in the Gaza Strip.
The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.
He has been denied again. Two efforts by former President Trump to delay his upcoming hush money trial in New York have been shot down within the last 24 hours. On Monday, Team Trump asked for a delay so the trial venue could be moved out of Manhattan. That appeal was denied in just 2 hours. And today, Trump asked for a stay in order to challenge a partial gag order imposed last week by Judge Juan Merchan. An appeals court judge took all of 12 minutes to reject that one. Joining me now is Christy Greenberg, a former federal prosecutor and former deputy chief of the criminal division for the Southern District of New York. Christy, thank you for joining me. You know, this may be kind of like an obvious observation, but how has this trial just stayed on track? What has Judge Merchan done that could be, I don't know, useful to other judges in handling their own cases, or just what sets us apart, this case apart, insofar as it's really, I mean, full steam ahead?
Well, I think in one circumstance, it's actually a very discrete set of facts. And every motion that comes up, every attempt that Donald Trump's team tries to throw a motion his way, he rules on them very, very quickly. He disposes of them quickly. He doesn't just sit on his hands like we've seen in Florida.
Yeah.
Right? Like in New York, he is moving things along. And it's easy because so many of these motions are frivolous. When you have a frivolous motion, it should be that much easier to dispose of it.
But it's not just Merchan, too. The appeals court judge dismisses this thing in 12 minutes, right? There seems to be a uniform New York judicial stance that, like, Trump's attempts here are bogus, and it is widely accepted that they are bogus.
Right. And, I mean, this should take 12 minutes, right? This is, oh, he has a First Amendment right to attack the family members of the court and of the district attorney. I mean, that's such a laughable argument. You should be laughed out of court if you're going to get up and make that argument.
I mean, having said that, there are some legitimate areas of tension between the prosecution and the defense. One of them is around a subpoena that the defense, Trump's team, would like to serve to Mark Pomerantz. The DA's office does not want, they want to squash the subpoena, basically. Pomerantz is a real person of interest here. And can you talk to me about why and how he might be useful to the Trump side of things?
So I actually don't think he will be as useful as they would like him to be. So a few days ago, Trump's team served a subpoena without notifying Alvin Bragg's team or even asking for authorization from the court, which is what a defendant has to do in a criminal case, to serve a subpoena on a third party, and served it just a few days ago and is asking for a number of things. And ultimately, Mark Pomerantz, when he was running this before Alvin Bragg came, he was the special assistant district attorney running this investigation. You know, presumably he has a lot of information, a lot of emails, a lot of memos that he wrote in his view of this prosecution. But all of that was turned over to the DA when he resigned, you know, quite some time ago. And as the DA points out in their papers, look, we've talked to him. We've said, do you have anything on your personal devices? Do you have anything still that we don't already have? And in their opposition to this subpoena, they lay out, look, here are all the efforts we made to get things from him. Here's his affirmation saying he gave us everything and there's nothing that he has that you don't already have. So again, I think this subpoena is not going anywhere for the Trump team.
And I get that the DA's office thinks it has exhausted any potential evidence that Pomerantz has. But Pomerantz sort of stands as a figure for those who don't believe that the Bragg investigation is as credible as perhaps D.A. Bragg would like to believe that it is. Pomerantz left in, I don't know, would we call it a fit? Is he jilted? Like, there is documented tension between him and D.A. Bragg's office over, you know, this case in particular. It feels like Trump is trying to use him as a weapon to get under D.A. Bragg's skin a little bit here, or...
Yes, though there were motions in limine about what arguments could be made, what evidence could be shown to the jury. And Mark Pomerantz's views, just like SDNY's views about Michael Cohen, about the strength of the case, none of that is coming before the jury. The judge has already ruled over a month ago that all of that evidence is not permissible evidence that gets before the jury. And Mark Pomerantz's issue with Alvin Bragg was that he wasn't being aggressive enough.
Exactly.
And now Alvin Bragg, after that book came out, charged a case. So, you know, I think the pressure points, were there interpersonal issues? Probably. It seems like in just reading Mark Pomerantz's book, he's got a lot of digs at Alvin Bragg along the way. But none of that is relevant evidence for the trial, and I don't think any of that will be coming in. But that, I agree with you, is what they are looking for.
Needling. Yes. You talked about the jury. Jury questionnaires went out today. There are no questions about, you know, whether who people voted for in the 2020 election, but there are questions about news media consumption. Yes, MSNBC is on the questionnaire, and whether or not they consider themselves supporters of or have belonged to the QAnon movement or Antifa. How unusual are these questions in the grand scheme of things? And do you feel like it's sufficient evidence to find out what channel someone watches and whether or not that gives an accurate window into their political leanings?
So those questions about where you consume your news media are pretty standard in any criminal trial. Any trial I had, we asked those kinds of questions. These are interesting because do you also follow Truth Social? Have you read Michael Cohen's book or listened to his podcast? Have you read Mark Pomerantz's book? So there, given how much is out there about these facts already, it does make it somewhat unique and different from other criminal cases. But, you know, I think the judge was right to say who you voted for, what political party you are affiliated with, whether you have donated. Those are questions that really don't bear on whether or not you have a clear bias. You could be a Republican and still listen to the evidence, put aside any views of who you think the president should be, and be fair and impartial. That is a possibility, and he's allowing for that in his questionnaire.
Yeah, and indeed, there is evidence of people who are diehard Trump supporters or left their MAGA hats in their car to return a verdict that was not did not benefit Donald Trump. So we know the past could be precedent.
Yeah, and we saw that in the E. Jean Carroll case. One of the jurors had identified as somebody who listened to more right-wing, you know, media consumption, having right-wing media consumption, and that was unanimous jury verdict in E. Jean Carroll's favor. So it is possible.
It is possible, and we're going to find out what happens in just a few days. Christy Greenberg, thank you for joining me on set tonight. Coming up, what does Jared Kushner have to do with Burger King? A lot, as it turns out. That's next. Burger King in Brazil has a few things Burger King in the U.S. does not, like a Nutella milkshake, poutine made with special Brazilian imitation cheese, and Jared Kushner. You heard me right. Today, the New York Times reported that Jared Kushner's investment fund is now a major investor in Burger King in Brazil. Now, this deal does not just complicate Kushner's relationship with the country of Brazil, because Kushner's fund didn't actually invest in Brazilian Burger Kings directly. What it actually did was team up with a subsidiary of the government-controlled Sovereign Wealth Fund of the United Arab Emirates to buy Brazilian Burger King stock. Kushner's investment group, Affinity Partners, has been entangled with foreign interests since its inception, when it received a $2 billion investment from Saudi Arabia's Sovereign Wealth Fund. Thanks to great reporting in The Times, we have gotten example after example of how Trump's son-in-law's investment group isn't just problematic on the fundraising side, but is also raising ethical questions about where it is investing. For instance, one might take issue with how Kushner is working to complete a government-backed deal in Serbia, where, according to a draft agreement reviewed by The Times, Kushner's fund would get a 99-year lease at no charge so it could build a luxury hotel and apartment complex on the site of a former NATO bombing. Or one might take issue with his investment group negotiating the lease of a government-owned island in Albania to build this luxury hotel. And even if you think, how much does the U.S. government really interact with a place like Albania anyway? Even if you think that kind of entanglement is not problematic for a potential second Trump administration, what about this one? Kushner's fund also invested with a car leasing company in Israel. And Kushner's partner at that car leasing firm is a part owner of the Israeli Navy's only domestic builder of warships. Because the U.S. provides Israel with billions of dollars in military aid each year, this means that if Donald Trump retakes office, he would be in a position to directly help or hurt his son-in-law's business partner. It is all not a great look. We are going to talk about what Kushner's foreign ties mean for Trump and American foreign policy with Ben Rhodes after the break. Right after Donald Trump left office, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence released a report finding that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, personally ordered the brutal murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The Saudi Arabian Sovereign Wealth Fund, controlled by MBS, then went against the objections of its own panel of risk advisors and invested an eye-popping $2 billion into Jared Kushner's investment firm, an investment that the New York Times reports today makes up a large percent of the 99% in foreign funding Kushner received to launch his group, Affinity Partners. Joining me now is to discuss all this is Ben Rhodes, former Deputy National Security Advisor under President Obama and co-host of Pod Save the World. Ben, thank you for being here with me. As you look at it from a sort of foreign policy perspective, how does Kushner's entanglement with someone like MBS compromise potentially, I don't know, the foreign policy platform of his father-in-law, who's running to be the next president of the United States?
Well, in a word, entirely, Alex. I mean, look, this is not subtle corruption that we're looking at. This is a guy, Jared Kushner, who had no expertise, no qualification whatsoever to be in the White House. While he was there, he made it his account to work in the Gulf Arab states. He basically helped lead the cover up for MBS, get him in from the cold after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And look, the Saudis didn't make a $2 billion investment because they trusted in Jared Kushner's investment expertise. Does anybody in the world believe that that $2 billion is based on an assessment that Jared Kushner is who you want to give your money to make a return? No, they're making an investment on what they think he can do for them if there is a second Trump term. And basically what we can take from that investment is that in a second Trump term, U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East and around the world will be made entirely with the interests of Mohammed bin Salman in mind.
Yeah, I do wonder. He's also taking money from the Qataris, who finance Hamas and have a sort of different role to play in the Middle Eastern conflict than, say, the Israeli investors, some of whom are in business with, in turn, the manufacturers of war machines, or at least the few war machines that are actually made in Israel. Do you think that complicates this in a way that neutralizes the issue? Or, I mean, how do you see that, the fact that he is equally invested with, or they are equally invested with him, the Qataris and the Israelis?
No, it just means it's all for sale, Alex. That's all it means. It's an auction, essentially, right? And this is how other countries work, right? More corrupt, smaller countries, literally where the president's son-in-law is down the hall. That's not a new phenomenon in the U.S. Essentially, what you have is whoever is the highest bidder gets whatever they want. Except in this case, it's the global superpower, the United States of America. And so I think what you can take from what Saudi Arabia and Qatar and other countries are doing is that they believe, based on their own experience of the first Trump term and their expectations for the second, that American foreign policy is essentially for sale.
Yeah.
And whoever comes in with the highest price gets what they want.
And what's so clear in the Times reporting is that these relationships that Kushner then cashed out on post-presidency were forged during the Trump administration. As an former administration official yourself, can you talk to me about how out of the ordinary that kind of relationship building is inside the White House?
Well, I mean, you could tell at the time, Alex, what he was doing. I mean, he made it a point to work on these accounts, right? And look, what's very clear here is that Jared Kushner, you know, he chose certain issues to work on when he was in the White House. He chose to work on issues in the Middle East, and he chose to work with the Gulf Arab states, knowing that the payout would be on the back end. And part of what's so grotesque here, which we should name, Alex, is that there's literally an impeachment inquiry going on now in search of a rationale that doesn't exist, that Hunter Biden somehow used his connection to his father to profit when Joe Biden was vice president. And they can't find any evidence for it. And here we have the president's son-in-law who worked in the White House, unlike Hunter Biden, who's collected $2 billion on the back end of his service. Now he's got his father-in-law running for president of the United States, right? This is not only unusual, this is unprecedented. This is just putting a price tag on American foreign policy. This is a level of corruption that we've just never seen. And it's hiding in plain sight. I mean, this is not subtle. This is 99% of his investors come from out of the United States. That is just saying that I've set up an entire investment fund designed to get me and my family rich based on the fact that people are going to be purchasing influence in a second Trump term while rewarding Jared Kushner for services well rendered in the first Trump term when he basically ran interference from Mohammed bin Salman after he murdered somebody, an American, a U.S. person, a Washington Post journalist in a consulate in Turkey.
We're going to leave it there to be continued. Jared Kushner not saying he's not going back into government service. Ben Rhodes, thank you, my friend, again for your time. That is our show for tonight.